Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Noom. Forget one-size-fits-all diets. With Noom, you get a personalized weight loss plan that's tailored to your lifestyle. No food is off limits. Enjoy your favorites while discovering healthier habits. Noom's users love the flexible approach, blending psychology and biology to help you lose weight in a way that's sustainable for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's N-O-O-M.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hey, welcome to the Nerdist Podcast. All right. If you live in Los Angeles, we're going to be performing June 2nd at Club Nokia. We will have guests, and I believe a musical guest. But I'm not going to say who it is yet. Because I'm a jerk. I would like to thank Hover.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Hover is about making domain registration simple. If you need to register a domain, if you need any service, they will do it. They will not try to sell you a bunch of crap you don't need. They just register your domain. They also have great customer service. There's a no-hold policy for customer service calls Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. You actually get to talk to a live human being and not a weird voicemail menu system, or they won't refer you to a website. You can also register premium domains at hover.com. Premium domains are domains that might have been previously purchased but now are available for sale. They're going to come up in your search results. Also, domains that are difficult to get, maybe if they're just simple words, like toast.com, they will help you try to pin those down. So if you need any kind of domain registration service, go to nerdist.hover.com today. If you need a standard non-premium domain, use the offer code Nerdist. You'll get 10% off. That discount does not apply to premium domains because they're really hard to get, you guys. That's nerdist.hover.com. Use the offer code Nerdist. Now, this episode of the Nerdist Podcast is my friend Scott Aukerman, who really helped bring so much amazing comedy to your eyes and ears. If you listen to this podcast, you're probably a fan of the Patton Oswalts and the Sarah Silvermans of the world. Scott co-founded Comedy Death Ray, I think, 10 years ago now, and it just pulled all of the LA comedy scene together and gave a stage for comics like that to develop their voices. And he's an amazing guy. And his new show, Comedy Bang Bang, premieres June 8th at 10 p.m. on IFC. Comedy Death Ray became Comedy Bang Bang. Scott also has a podcast of the same name. So he's just a great guy and a really smart guy. And he has done shit tons for comedy. So here is the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 210 with Scott Aukerman.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Very unprofessional today, Scott Aukerman. I have no headphones for you.
Goodness. I don't cotton to this kind of...
You don't...
bullshit.
I don't cotton to the term cotton.
Oh, okay.
Of just not...
My favorite actor is Joseph Cotton.
Okay. All right. I enjoy the cotton gin. For any Eli Whitney fans out there.
The Cotton Dumpling Gang.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think that was the Apple Dumpling Gang. The Cotton Dumpling Gang? No, you're not supposed to say cough when you push the cough button.
Is that really? It just like blanks out for a second.
Just blanks out for a second. Yeah, if you have to cough, you hold that button and then it blanks out. See?
Anyway.
I picked it up on my mic, but it's not directly into... Yeah. I'm so glad to finally have you on, Scott Aukerman, because
It's you are a you and Earwolf are titans in and pioneers in the podcasting game.
Just talking to me.
I'm just talking to you. I'm not recording any of this. I'm gonna.
You have such a strange tone of voice when you just talk to me in just normal conversation.
What are you talking about?
Like you're an announcer or something.
What are you talking about, Scott?
What are you talking about?
Scott Earwolf, and I'm just making conversation here. You guys.
This is before we're rolling, of course.
We're not
the way friends chat with each other.
We're rolling on that tape over there. Yeah, I said tape.
What did you say?
Nothing. I was just hanging out with my old friend, Scott Aukerman.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Scott.
I'm glad to be here on the show. Thank you so much for having me.
We had talked, just so people know, we've been talking for quite a long time about having you on, and then we kind of just wanted to position the appearance with a bunch of stuff that you have going on. And so, but we'll get to that in a minute. First of all, thank you for being a pillar in the LA comedy scene. I don't really remember what comedy was like before.
Oh, come on.
Before Death Ray.
Before I started producing a show, it was.
But that show at M-Bar in, you know, when did you start it, 2002 or three?
2002, yeah. Chris is talking about I produce a live comedy show. It was called Comedy Death Ray for a long time. Now it's called Comedy Bang Bang,
mm-hmm.
stand up.
Mm-hmm.
And almost 10 years now. So
fuck.
It was September 30th, I think, 2002. And yeah. Every week, every Tuesday.
I remember around that time going to Joe, who owns the M Bar.
Joe Reynolds, yeah.
On Fountain
Vine
and Vine.
And, yeah.
And early in 2002 and saying, oh, I'd really love to do like a regular comedy show here. And he said, oh, well, I just met with these other guys who want to do a show. I didn't know it was you.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, okay, well, if they're going to do it, that sounds
that's
good.
That's easier for me.
So,
would your life have been like? What if we had swapped lives?
And
God. You know what? I want to be a multimedia mogul who starts a YouTube channel.
No, but you are doing all that stuff. I mean, you have a, you were podcasting. You're a pioneer in the comedy podcast field.
You know, you can almost say that about anyone because there's like certain stages of like you can say that about like Ricky Gervais. Okay, you were a pioneer, and then people like,
he really was.
But then I was talking to Jimmy Pardo about his show, and when he first started, he's like, am I too late to this podcasting game?
Yeah, and that and was like what, like 07 or something?
Yeah, he was doing it way before either of us. So like, I don't know. I've been doing it 3 years now. We just celebrated our third anniversary. So 3 years is pretty good. I mean, I guess you can be called a pioneer of anything if it takes 3 years to be successful.
Well, but I mean, you know, because you were doing Death Ray over at Indy 103.1.
Right across the street.
Right across the street.
This very building.
Yeah. And you guys, you know, figured out pretty quickly, like, oh, well, this should be a podcast and this should be a regular thing.
Yeah,
and
I mean, I didn't figure it out necessarily as much as the station said, hey, do you mind if we podcast this show? And me sort of knowing what a podcast was because I was on Jimmy Pardo's Never Not Funny. I was like, yeah, that sounds good to me if you want to do it. I don't know how to do it or anything. And they hosted it. They put it up on whatever site hosted it originally, and it came out as a podcast, and I just kind of was like, oh, that's good.
Well, I knew that what you were doing was becoming a thing when I would tour around, and I started seeing a couple years ago people wearing the Comedy Death Ray t-shirts.
Right.
And then going, shit.
How do they get them?
Where did those come from? But, you know, as a guy who, and I, you know, I'm sure a lot of people know, but.
You are a guy, yes.
As a guy.
I co-sign on that.
Is it, tell me about nipples.
Let's talk about guy stuff, Chris. Come on.
You know how when you want your balls to play a football game, but your old lady's tits are full of beer and you're like, what a great life. Let's go get some wings. Those are all touch
Let's
points.
Let's break them off my old lady's back.
Those
crack.
Are all motorcycles. Wait, was that a macaw that was breaking off in the back of
Yeah, it's
your...
my old lady, my macaw. My macaw.
No, it's not, I'm sorry, there's a misunderstanding. The macaw's name is my old lady.
Yeah, exactly. It's a dude macaw.
Yeah, is it? I'm not, whatever.
And its tits are full of beer.
That's a horrible nuclear accident. It's a lie. It's very detailed.
Didn't I mention I live in Chernobyl?
My apologies for not laying out this very detailed riff early on. But these are all the components.
Riffs are based on misunderstandings, as you know.
Constantly. Because you start
Constant
saying
clarifications
things,
and misunderstandings.
You really have to let people know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But you've always, but you know, your history from what I...
Herstory.
Your herstory.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
gender non-specific.
I'm sorry,
please.
Scott Acker, woman.
Thank you.
Was that...
God, I'm just like, literally that triggered something in me from like elementary school.
Oh, no.
Like, you motherfucker.
Couldn't have been worse than growing up with Hardwick.
I don't know how to make fun of that.
You and BJ Porter were a writing team, the Fun Bunch.
Yeah, we wrote on Mr. Show and we wrote movies together and a lot of scripts that never got made. But we were paid for, so that's kind of how we lived for a long time. And then, you know, what was weird is we started in the stand-up alternative comedy scene back in 1995 is when we started, with Patton and Paul F. Tompkins and Jeanine Garofalo and Margaret Cho and all people like that. But once we started writing and writing got really busy for us, we stopped kind of being around stand-up comedy all that much. And then you and I kind of, or I don't mean to say you and I did it at the, we did it at the same time is what I mean. Like when I started kind of getting back into doing open mics and stuff.
Yeah.
You and I were kind of struck up a friendship at that point.
Yeah. Like around 99, 2000 maybe?
2000 or so. And we would go do open mics a lot. And I sort of remembered how fun it was to perform again. So when BJ came to me and said, "Hey, I've been talking to Joe Reynolds at the M Bar. I want to do a show and you're performing a lot. You know all the good comedians. Why don't we do it together?" That's kind of how it all started. And just out of, you know, sitting, I didn't want to sit around my room all day just writing scripts and never see any of my friends again. And then that's really the reason I keep doing it, you know, the why 10 years I've still continued is because I would miss seeing everybody.
Yeah.
You know, like it would be weird to just kind of retire and then never see any of you guys
ever. I know
again.
It sounds sad, but. But left to my own social devices, I would never just go out and hang out with people.
Yeah, I would never hang out with Jonah Ray. I have to book a show for him to be in.
There needs to be a structure in place. I can't just meet someone at a food establishment.
I've known Jonah since he moved out here. I love Jonah.
Well, he's not here today, is he?
No, he doesn't love me that much. He would have quit his job if he would wanted to be
here. He would have quit his job, and so would have Matt.
Yeah.
So would have Matta.
So would it matter?
So would it matter?
Welcome back to the Italiano, Chris Hardwick.
It's nice to be here. Oh my, you guys, so we have a great show today.
In communist Russia, show shows you.
Hey, get away from me, Ruski. I'm Italiano.
Another great riff.
Vespa.
I say two solid riffs so far.
Pretty good.
Uh-huh.
Pretty good. I mean, listen. And I may be wrong by saying this, you can never go wrong with stereotypes.
No,
you just can't go wrong with them.
You can't go wrong, and you are not wrong.
No, they're...
And two wrongs do not make a right, unfortunately, so you are not right either.
Easily... Oh, you just painted
I'm
me
so
into
sorry.
A weird
Thank you for playing.
Logic corner. Stereotypes are easy, they're fun, they only slightly hurt people.
That's
I mean,
right.
Come
I mean,
on.
But if you're a member of someone that there's a stereotype, a member of a race or something... You're used to it by now, right? And sometimes it benefits you. If you're a black guy, you're walking around going, you know, pointing down at your shorts, you know, you benefit from that.
That is a beneficial stereotype.
Yeah, exactly.
But not so good on the white guy end. We didn't
no,
benefit from
we only
that
have medium-sized penises.
Medium.
Compared to Asian people.
Whoa, hey, what? I don't sanction that. We're the grande of the...
Yes.
Of the...
Black guys are venti... White guys are grande, and Asian guys are tall.
No, I can't support that.
That's the only time that sentence has ever been said, by the way. Asian guys are tall.
I do not support that.
I'm not this type of comedian, Chris. You're backing me into a corner.
I didn't tell you to say that stuff.
Come on, man. I don't appreciate that.
Why are you putting it off on me?
You started this whole thing.
You're right. I take full responsibility. Scott, I would like to apologize to you and all of the Asian community.
Apology not accepted.
What? Now you're speaking on behalf of them? How did that happen?
They do not accept your apology.
But did you talk to them?
Rise up, tiny Asian
Stop
people.
Stop it. What are you doing? Please, their technology alone could level us.
Three solid riffs. I'm counting that in the win column. I'll let you know if we ever have a loser. So far, that has not happened.
I feel like we're 2.5-0. I don't know, for 3.
2.5-0 men.
But you started this amazing show, the Comedy Death Ray, which immediately became popular. And I think there were a lot of reasons. I mean, number one, it was just the right time. And number two...
People were looking for a performance space.
There was, and you know this from, if you remember from going to all the different, you know, open mics and shows around LA, is there was no kind of centralized
You had to drive to the west side. People who don't live in California, but you had to drive all over the place to perform on any given night. And the great thing about where we were doing the show is it was right in the middle of Hollywood. I think it was successful because it was a quality show for the money. You would see really famous people, but we had a really sincere desire to feature new people because the show was kind of a reaction to other shows that were around town at the time that were only having the same famous people on in rotation. And there were so many people who, like, for instance, Todd Glass. Todd couldn't get on those shows. Like, right. He wasn't cleared to be on any of the popular shows. And Todd's one of the best comedians in the world, in my opinion. So for me, it was just like, Todd, you're a regular on our show. Come on, you know. And he, you know, he would be on all the time. So on any given night, you would see. I remember one show early on in those days where it was like, we had, I think it was like Bob Odenkirk, and two other really like Pattons and Zach Galifianakis's, and they were all late, and Louis C.K. was the only guy there, so he ended up doing an hour while we waited for them to get there. You know, it was like that kind of energy all the time.
Those shows were so much fun, and not only that, but there was a sort of unspoken encouragement to try weird things.
Yeah, weird new stuff.
Experiment. You know, Furman and I did a lot of our... I mean, we had done a little bit of Hard and Firm stuff together in college. That sounded weird, but we really kind of started again at Comedy Death Ray, and that's where we started doing like the Greatest American Hero piece.
You did
and
a Tron musical,
the Tron
like
rock
a 25
opera,
minute rock opera.
Yeah, and then the Corazon, like any of the pieces that ended up becoming what was on our the songs that were sort of our go-to bits that we put on our album.
Gautier.
Yes, Gautier.
Gautier.
Yep.
So sorry to mispronounce that fucking weirdo name.
Cinnamon banana.
I am counting that in the lost column.
Really?
Yep, so sorry.
Nope. You mean a storyline that would have been on Lost? Cinnamon bananas?
Cinnamon bananas.
That's what the Black Rock was carrying, cinnamon bananas. And then they crashed.
Black Rock, that's Living Color, isn't it?
Yes.
Hey.
In the venti column.
All right.
Tying it all together.
Yep. Callbacks.
But, you know, it was just a great place to experiment, try new stuff. We did a lot of joke machines there, which was our
yeah, joke machine was your, I loved that format, and you were the host of that, right?
I was the host, Greg Lobb and Tom Sharp.
Tom Sharp's back.
We're having lunch in a couple days.
He wrote on our Between Two Ferns special.
But those early shows, when you look back, it's like, Sarah, Louie, Patton, Proops, Zach Galifianakis, Swardson, Jerry Minor.
Also a lot of young comedians as well. Jonah, I mean, I would have to say Jonah started, that was one of the first shows.
Mr. Propularity. Where he'd come with props and do stuff. And it was a genius little formula, a very simple but genius formula of, you know, we're going to book a couple people that everyone's heard of to get people in the seats. And then we're going to throw these sort of
new people who you will love
that are in the same kind of sphere. Mm-hmm. Comedically, not same acts, but just like the same type of, it was like a genius playlist. If you like this, you like this.
Yeah. So it really worked well for people, I think, who were just starting out. I mean, I knew all these great people, BJ Novak and Dan Mintz and Morgan Murphy, all these people who had just moved to town. Like literally when we were doing that open mic in Westwood, BJ Novak came up to me. He had just moved here, I think, you know, that week or something. It was like, oh, I'm a big Mr. Show fan. And we just struck up a friendship and I loved his jokes so much.
Yeah.
And so it just became kind of like a cool scene for people who weren't, quote, approved, unquote, to do the big shows around town. They now were getting stage time on a big, what turned out to be a big show.
Yeah. And the M-Bar shows, I remember after like maybe a year or two looking around and being like, is that fucking Keanu Reeves? Like it just pulled in this weird
groups
collection of, you know, of hardcore comedy nerds, and then people where you're like, is this becoming a scene now? Like, why is those? That's crazy.
Well, you know, I've always resisted the whole becoming a scene thing, to be honest. Like, and you know, I mean, look, the show is continuing now, and it's you know, we don't release who's on it anymore. But you know, I mean, back in the day, I really didn't want it to become this thing where like Suits came to it and where...
Right. No industry comps.
No industry comps. Performers only get two comps. And because a lot of times, you know, performers would go, hey, can I have 20 seats? Because yeah. All my agents want to come, you know? But yeah, I wouldn't do any industry comps. Like we would get constant calls from CA, from every big agency saying they wanted to come, quote unquote, cover the show. And I wouldn't let any of them do it. I would say, if you want to come, you got to pay $5. And they would all go, where am I supposed to get $5? I don't carry that little amount of money. I only have hundreds.
You know, why would we want to help support a show in town? Yeah. We just want to go to things for free.
But it was a great way to weed out people who weren't serious, who just kind of heard about something that was popular and wanted to come hang out and not actually watch. I wanted people who wanted to watch the show.
Yeah.
That's the thing. And I barely ever tape seats for anyone. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to come, you have to get there. You have to risk sitting on stage to watch it. You know, you have to really want to see the show, because there's a lot of people who really want to see it every week.
Well, and I think that a lot of people who, you know, the people who come really get the sense that they're a part of something that's unique and kind of special. And those shows feel very communal. Like, they always felt very communal to me, of like, that the people were super excited to be there. And even though people were crammed in, and, you know, especially at M-Bar.
Especially Ralph Cramden.
He was very crammed in. At M-Bar, they were serving food and there was a bar. And so it was always super, super, super packed.
Right. And now I should say that it's moved to the UCB Theater in L.A. now for the past 6.5 years.
I'm an idiot. I thought that was going to be the death of the show. I was like, no one's going to sit in theater seats in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And they did.
I was worried about it. But, you know, I was at the time I was considering stopping the show anyway, because I was nothing against the M-Bar. It's a great place. I just I was tired of trying to fill the M-Bar every time. I wanted to move somewhere a little more intimate, because I started feeling like, oh, every show's got to have major headliners on so I can fill this 150, 160 seat place, you know? So I moved it to a tiny 99 seat theater.
But it is really hard to book a regular show. It's hard. If it's hard to book a monthly show, I know it sounds not hard,
right?
But just booking a consistent show is hard, because, you know, performers are unintentionally difficult. People always want to go up when they want to go up. They don't. Yeah. Some people don't show up. Other people want to show up when they weren't booked. And it's like, it's a really hard thing.
Some weeks it's incredibly hard. I'm lucky enough that it's a little easier for me now, because comedians want to do the show, but there are those weeks where it's like, I had one recently where I was like, man, this show's so easy. I just basically, like, 3 months beforehand, I ask people when they want to do the show. I put together the lineup. I barely have to show up. And then one night, 4 people dropped out like 5 minutes before the show.
Oh,
and
shit.
I'm like scrambling around trying to find comedians. And, you know, I mean, back in the old days at M-Bar, you could just talk to any of the 30 comedians who are just hanging out getting drinks,
right,
and go, okay, can you go up? You know, but now, because it's a theater, there's, you know, a lot of comedians aren't hanging out necessarily the way they used to. But
yeah, and it really was, you know, we just had John Hamm on the podcast again, and he was talking about, like,
lucky.
Yeah, I used to, you know, he talked about you and said
that
he used to go to the Tuesday night shows because it was cheap and fun, and not that's where all of his friends were
going.
He's
a cheapskate.
He does not, even today.
He's a miser. He's very thrifty.
But it's fun to see that it has grown from just being a show that was popular for a while, and then like some other shows just sort of fizzle out and you know.
You know, every time I keep thinking about quitting, that's the thing. I just go, well, how would I see these people again? So, you know, like the busier I get, the harder it gets a little bit. And the 10-year anniversary is coming up in September, and I'm like tempted. That's such a round number. I'm tempted to.
Those
to
all quit. Night anniversary shows were so much fun.
Yeah.
I think it was it the first year through like the fifth year, maybe?
I think it was the second through the fifth, maybe. We did what we basically did was we would start the show at 8 p.m. and we would go until we said we would go until 6 a.m. The first year we said we'll just go until everyone walks out because no one will stay that long.
Oh, yeah.
But everyone stayed.
People showed up in their pajamas, and because it was a bar, you had to lock the doors.
Mm-hmm.
We
had to lock the gates, as Mark Maron has talked about many times.
And I remember that show. I did a set at the beginning of the show, and then Furman and I closed the show, but all night took notes of during people's sets. And then close the show with a parody of Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire.
Oh, I thought it was R.E.M.'s It's the End of the World.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. I'm sorry. You're right. It was R.E.M.'s It's the End of the Show. The End of the Show as we know it. The End of the World as we know it. And then we basically just took events that happened the whole night.
That was so genius.
That was the song. And that was way harder than I don't know. It was like
I mean, if anyone could pull that off, that was you and Firm. I mean, you guys are like, you know, such incrediminds.
Oh, thanks. Know? It was really fun, but we were so wiped out by the end of that. Like, my God.
Because we were the Phil Collins of the show. You performed in Live Aid. You performed then, in London and then flew to Philadelphia.
Just as important, I'm gonna say too. Just as important as Live Aid.
Of course.
But we did not stop writing for that entire 8 hours of just like taking notes.
It was fantastic. Yeah. Those were great. We did those three times. The very last year we started at 8. I think we started at 7. We did a pre-show maybe, and then we started at 8. And then it went, we were scheduled till 6, but those things run long. No one wants to stick to their time. We got out at 8:30 in the morning for the last one, and they were really special. They're really amazing shows. I may do one more. I don't know. I'm contemplating retirement is what I'm trying to say.
I know. I think one more might be fun though. One more could be fun.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a whole brand new crop of people who are all really good now. It's been interesting to do that show and see kind of the rise of people who are really popular now, like Aziz, you know, and to see the people who are just starting out now be really popular, and then to see find it really interesting the people who went away who are not comedians anymore, you know? I mean, that's always
Who quit?
There's people I think about. I mean, I don't know that I want to name names of people who quit and tar
but
them
just
with kind of
stopped.
But a Tammy Vernikov, for instance.
Oh, right.
Her,
yeah, Tammy was great.
Yeah, there's all sorts of people who just, I think about sometimes, I look at the old lineups. I wrote down everyone who's ever been on the show. I've written a list of every single show.
Yeah.
And I just look at old lists sometimes and go, whatever happened to that person? Whatever happened
to
that
person? Well, I think stand-up is can be a difficult, you know, when you've been doing it for, I think sometimes people get maybe to the 10 or 15 year mark and then they go, okay, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Am I going to be a touring comedian for the rest of my life? Or should I focus, you know, should I just kind of skew this into writing a little bit more or acting or, you know.
Are you there right now? Is that what's happening?
God, it's me, Margaret.
Am I witnessing this?
No, I'm not there yet. I don't know if I'll ever stop doing stand-up. I don't know. Like when I see people, you know, like comedians and they get really famous and they just stop doing stand-up, I never understand that because I don't know why.
Yeah,
why would never want to
doing
not...
it in the first place?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know, but it's tough. It is hard. It's like I can understand wanting to take a break. Like I respect the people like Louis or Jim Gaffigan who just are like, no, this is what I worked this hard so I can continue doing it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
And it's hard if you don't if you take too long a break, then it's just like,
well, that's the thing they say about Eddie Murphy is like everyone wants him to start doing stand up again, but it's like it's been 25 years. How do you ever start again?
And not only that, but a guy like that, because of who he is, no one is ever going to, like, audiences are not going to forgive him in the workshopping process.
No one will cut him any kind of a break.
Because obviously his first handful of sets are, you know, they're going to have rough patches because that's just how comedy works. And everyone's going to be like, boo, I thought you were supposed to be the great comedian.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if he did like the Chappelle model where he just was like, I'm going to talk for 2 hours. You'll like some of it. You won't like some of it.
I just wish Eddie Murphy would go and just do weird character roles instead of starring.
I know.
When you
love his characters. Bowfinger.
Fucking Bowfinger is one of my favorite movies and one of my favorite role, the dual role.
Mm-hmm.
But just that the Nebuchadnezzar character,
he's so funny. I even like Norbit just to watch him do characters. You know what I mean?
When he does a character, it's not like, he's a guy acting a character. Like he just becomes the character seamlessly.
He's an amazing actor.
And I think there's a weird thing when you're a movie star of like, oh, you got to take these movie style leading roles.
Well, I've thought about that and, you know, not to hypothesize about something that I do not know about, nor will ever know about, being the lead in movies. But I've thought about people like that, like, say, someone who I greatly admire, Steve Martin,
mm-hmm, for instance. Course.
Okay, you can start saying, well, why does Steve Martin do the Pink Panther? Why does he do the whatever movies? I think it's because when you are above the title, if you could choose doing something really cool, but it will then mean you will never be above the title again. Like if it fails, you will, you know, if you just do cool movies that are funny, you all of a sudden will no longer be a movie star.
Right.
Or you have to just do whatever movie you can get to be above the title. And I think that applies to Eddie Murphy too, sometimes, of like, you go, why not choose a cool movie? Well, it's because these are the only movies being offered to them that will, it's really hard to put together a movie that will get put together, that will come out, that a marketing team will get behind, and you will be a movie star. You'll be above the title. Those are the only ones that he can get. It's not like he's like picking between really great scripts and, you know, Daddy Daycare or whatever. I don't know what kind of movies, you know, and I don't mean to say those are bad movies either. I just think that that's why people make those kinds of choices, you know, because, you know, you have to, I mean, the people who have been able, like Steve Martin has been a movie star since 1978 or 1979.
Yeah.
That's an incredible run. I mean, you know, like Stallone and John Travolta couldn't even keep that going. I mean, he's been up and down for so long, you know, but like to be above the title is really, and to keep it going that long is crazy.
I also think there's a certain degree of, you know, to be a sort of like on the edge comedian type, there's a certain degree of, there's a certain degree of like hunger that you need to sort of have or not desperation, but it's definitely, there's definitely a thirst. And I think when you get a little bit older,
a hunger, a thirst,
you're hungry and thirsty.
What else do humans get?
They poopy.
Yeah. They get poopy.
Hungry, thirsty, poopy, sweaty.
I thought you were all of a sudden telling the story of the Hunger Games.
Yep. So basically Eddie Murphy right now is, like Katniss Everdeen.
Oh boy, you really had to pull that out of the recesses of your mind. You are the Nerdist, Chris. I expect you to know things like this. You were like, you looked at me with such pleading eyes. Katniss Everdeen, please.
I you know, I enjoyed The Hunger Games. I saw the movie. I did not read The Hunger Games books.
I didn't read it. I thought the movie was kind of boring.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what I did like that there was pretty full on murder in the. I mean, like for a movie that could have been where they could have like handled that, like, well, these are going to be for young people, so we should really kind of ixnay the murder.
You've seen more horrifying murders on TV. How come you can see like really gross murders on TV, but you have to pull back on murders for a PG-13 movie? It's so
because no one can complain about murders in life. They make themselves feel important by complaining to standards and practices about things.
Yeah, I mean, if like that movie would have been like, just make it grisly like the books and get abolish the rating system and let people see it if they want to see it, still would have been popular. I don't know. I hate the rating system, so
it is kind of a weird. It is just sort of like still hanging on this outdated system for how we
from 40 years ago. I mean, come on, let's just get rid of it. No one cares anymore. That's the thing. Like, no one cares about cursing.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, has anyone ever said about your show, oh, I wish I could listen to the Nerdist because I love the Nerdist so much, but I can't stand it when he says the F word?
Only a couple times, and it's been in reference to like, I'd love to listen to the show with my kids, but I can't because they're swearing. And I'm like,
their kids. And fuck you, Chris.
Wait, how did this turn on me?
Forget it. I'm out of here.
What happened?
Slam cough.
I don't know what I said. Wait, you left and then you coughed? I don't understand.
That's a little inside joke to something we were talking about before.
There's no slam button. You need a slam button for
a big bright yellow button that says cough right in front of me. That is actually making me want to cough. It's lit up like,
it's suggesting.
Alert, cough.
Don't you feel a tickle, Scott? Just a little tickle.
Oh, got to press it.
A little tickle. I do like your theory about why people take certain movies though, but I do think as you get older, you just don't, that need to really be on the edge is just like, I don't have the energy anyway. It takes a lot of energy to do that, I think.
Well,
for
you
people.
Wonder if Steve Martin could he even do a movie like The Jerk anymore? He's a totally different person from
completely
1979.
Different. Yeah,
you know,
totally
what I mean?
Different.
Like,
person.
I think he may have even said that at one point. I'm just appropriating it, but. You know, you can say, hey, do something like The Jerk again. And he would just go, how? I have no idea. I wouldn't know how to do any of my Fun Bunch act from 1995 necessarily. Oh, well, that's okay. I would never.
What about the one where you and BJ start making out and jerking off in your underwear?
You mean every single one that we ever did? Yeah. Okay. I would still know how to do that, but still.
you were in the last few seasons of Mr. Show, the last couple seasons of Mr. Show, right?
Well, when you say in, I had a small part in the second season, but I worked on the show the fourth season.
Okay.
So I wrote on the show and then I was in, I guess a de facto cast member, although I wasn't listed as a cast member, but you know, all the writers were kind of in every show to varying degrees.
Was it easy to be on staff between like Bob and David, who are, you know, kind of like the driving brains on the show? Like,
meaning were they pleasant to work with?
Well, I mean, just like, was it sort of like super, super, super collaborative? Or was it like, oh, we'll write stuff and then Bob and David all sort of.
Oh, it was very collaborative. It was, you know, that whole writing process was a reaction to, I think, Bob's time on SNL. So he was collaborative, I think, to a fault. I mean, I'm not faulting him. What I'm saying is that
it sounded like you just faulted him.
I'm sorry to fault you, Bob.
Is there a fault button?
Bob, are you listening?
Hit the fault button.
Bob! I was thinking about this the other day about how, like, I just I've been working on my show, right? My TV show, and I'm the last say, right? Before it goes out. Like any everyone can have their own opinions, from the other writers to the directors to the producers, and everyone can tell me what they think about a certain thing. But if I don't like it, I change it, you know, and it's weird to be the last stop in a show like that. You know what I mean? So I was thinking about this with Bob and David, how there was a sketch that Bob didn't like that I had written the main drafts of. I wrote with several other people, with David and BJ, I think, but the Monk Academy sketch, where the basic premise is that Bob is a 17-year-old Van Halen fan who finds out he's the new Dalai Lama. He's been reincarnated as the new Dalai Lama. And it's hard to explain. Okay, just watch it, season 4. But Bob didn't like that sketch very much. And I remember him like fighting against it. And all the writers were like, no, we all think it's funny. We all think it's funny. And he eventually said, it's just first year writer bullshit.
Oh, shit.
Which is kind of, you know, one of the more mean things he said. But to his credit, like I say, I'm the last say in my show. On my show, I probably would have said, nah, we're not doing it.
Yeah.
Because I did that with a lot of sketches on my show. I just go, I'm not feeling this. This isn't, you know, it's probably funny. It's funny for someone else, but it's just not me, right? And he very well could have said that and just said, nah, we're not going to do the sketch. And that would have been it. But to their credit, those guys were very much like always collaborative. And even though they were, you know, Bob is one of the greatest sketch writer, or the greatest sketch writer, I think, that I at least have ever known. And I think Smigel and Conan, probably they all work together. I think those two are probably just as good. You know, I've never worked with them.
Yeah.
But Bob is amazing at it. But to his credit, he never just steamrolled anybody. He wanted to hear everyone's opinion. And that's the great thing I learned about writing on that show, is you could have pitched an idea and he just would have went, eh, or made fun of you or said no. He would always go, well, why? What is funny about that to you? And you'd explain it. And you'd go, yeah, I can. You always had to have a reason why something was funny. If you could explain that and articulate that, he would go, okay, I see why you think that's funny. Let's explore it in a different execution. And then we would sit there for an hour and try to figure out what the sketch could be.
That's so smart, especially in a business which is largely driven by egos, where he could have just been like, yeah, I don't see that.
Yeah. Anyway, here's my thing that I decided.
Yeah, I'll take that and then kind of make it your own thing. But you've always managed to, and I think one of the reasons why, you know, you've been able to keep Death Ray alive, or Bang Bang alive, for so long, is you're always experimenting and you're always collaborating and you're always You know, it's like, oh, let's expand. Now we'll do this radio show. Now it's the podcast. Now we'll do characters. Let's make a calendar and give it to the fans, like the Comedy Death Ray calendars. Or,
yeah, I love doing that.
Or like Halloween shows where you would, you know, just totally trick out the UCB. And
we do a monster maze getting into
it. Everyone would get involved and like comedians would jump out. I mean, it was all, I can see the roots of what you were just saying, because there is a collaborative community that you've been able to build and expand mm-hmm. around. And
which, I love collaborating and I love to think about, and you know, the all night shows are a part of that. I mean, those were not my idea. I believe it was Dave Rath and Neil Mahoney who we were at a party and they said, what if you did a show that lasted till all night till 6 in the morning? I just love trying to figure out what you can achieve with something. You know what I mean? Like, what is the limit of what you can do? When I thought of, I approached the UCB the first year we were there for the Halloween show, and I said, I have this weird idea where I want to do a haunted maze before you get into the show. Before the show happens, you have to go through this haunted maze. And they were all like, no, you you can't do that. What are you talking about? I was like, well, what if we did? And I started explaining, like, what if we like cordoned off this part of the theater and like led them through the backstage and all that? And they're like, you're crazy. No, I go, look, I only need $500 to do this. Can you just give me the entire proceeds of the show? And they were like, just stop talking to us. And like, and then I got a whole bunch of interns and we just did it. And it's like, the calendar is the same thing where it's like, I just thought it would be really fun for us all to have a calendar that we all started and took pictures in. Yeah. I just thought that was a really funny idea. And they cost as much as we made on them, and they were a pain in the and a lot of work. And Robin Van Swank, who's this yeah. amazing photographer, took them, and it was a lot of work for her. But at the end of the day, I think it's the sun sets, and then we all go to sleep. No, okay, I hate that expression. But I just really want to put out cool things that even if they don't make any money or anything like that, I just want to say I did it. And like, I look at the calendar and I'm proud of it. You know yeah. what I mean?
Well, and I also really loved the yearly auctions for the LA Food Bank. You all raised right. a shitload of money through yeah. like just getting, and you know, and I see it's fun because you sort of built your core. I mean, it's going to sound boring the way I'm going to describe this, and I apologize, but you
get ready, Nerdist fans.
I know, I'm sorry, but you sort of built your core business, which was, here's a show that's really communal and fun that everyone loves, and you know, how can we expand that in different ways and utilize the talent that's involved and spin it off into a bunch of different things. And so, and this was a great example of every year Scott would do this this eBay auction. And so everyone from the community, the comedy community, would donate something, whether it be a dinner with Sarah Silverman or...
Yeah, Sarah Silverman would like, she Skyped a Christian family on Christmas Day because she was like, I'm not doing anything that day. I'll Skype with you and your family.
Yeah.
So people bid on that. Or like Steve Agee and Brian Posehn went over to some guy. They drove to Riverside to go to some guy's house to watch a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie with him.
Well, we had one of now who's become kind of a girl who's become our pal, this girl, Mindy Hollihan, who donated, you know, I don't know, $1,500 or mm-hmm. something to be a guest on our podcast.
Oh, so she was the guest.
She came on and she was great, and she's been writing crafty stuff for us on the website, great. And she turned out to be really cool.
You know who I saw the other day was the very first winner of the what we also would auction off. You could host our live show,
mm-hmm.
the Comedy Death Ray live show. We auctioned that off, and a guy, I'm forgetting where he's from, but Tim Young had never done stand-up before, and he bid on it. He flew out to L.A. He performed on the show for the very first time. We wrote him like sketch material mm-hmm. and some jokes, but he also wrote some jokes on his own
yep.
that he had never done before. He did it, and I saw him, and that was 3 or 4 years ago, as I recall. I saw him the other day. He came to L.A., and he's now a professional touring comedian.
Oh, that's awesome.
And he's like, I never would have tried it without that. So thank you so much.
That's really cool.
It was really, really cool.
I think I also was pretty blown away by, I think Patton gave up his Carvel card or something.
Yeah, that was crazy. That went for so much money.
It was literally like $13,000 or $14,000, right?
It was way more than that. It was like $33,000.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Like
yeah, he was given Carvel, the ice cream company, donated, I believe, 100 or 150 black cards to certain celebrities. Dina Lohan famously got in trouble for taking Lindsay Lohan's and trying to get free ice cream out of from it all the time.
Well, that's hard to believe. They seem like great parents.
But Patton had one, and, you know, I mean, that's like a recipe for death, I think. You know, free ice cream for life if you're Patton.
Right.
So he said, hey, I'm going to give mine away. I'm not going to use it. He auctioned it for us. The person who bought it paid somewhere around $33,000 for it. And we were like, God, who wants that much ice cream? We found out it was actually a guy who was starting a charity on his own where he goes, he gets a free ice cream cake from Carvel with a black card every week. And he goes to children's hospitals and he gives them to the children in the hospital.
Double charity.
Yeah.
So he donated to the LA Food Bank and he's taking that and then getting, oh.
So just a fantastic...
That guy's going to get so blown in heaven.
Oh, my God. St. Peter's just going to wrap his lips around his ghostly cock.
Wait, are they ghosts or angels? Are they ghosts?
I think ghosts live in heaven.
I think they're just ghosts that live down here.
No. Angels live down here. I wish they had a button that said burp, because I think I just burped into the mic. I'm so sorry, listeners.
Well, there isn't, so that you're just going to have to burp into the mic until we can get...
Will technology catch up with man's desires?
Until we can make buttons for every possible thing that could come out of a person's body.
They have a snot?
There's a snot button. There's an earwax button.
Diarrhea.
There's a pre-cum button. You wouldn't hear that, but
pre-cum
just...
Pre-cum button.
Yeah, there's a pre-cum button.
They have a cum button, a pre-cum button.
The pre-cum button's on top.
Pre-cum. Ugh. I'm so sorry, listeners, that you've had to hear two gentlemen talking about pre-cum.
So let's shift the talk to post-cum. There's a little bit
snuggling. My favorite part of sex.
Post-cum. So $33,000.
Yeah, we raised that year, because of the efforts of Patton, we raised $87,000 for the LA Food Bank. Last December, I got unusually busy making my TV show, so we only raised $30,000 because I wasn't able to do the auction.
Well, it's hard because you're running. I mean, there are somewhere, it's got to be like 30 or 40 different simultaneous auctions.
The auctions are a huge. I have to credit my wife, Kulapi Lysok, from the Who Charted podcast.
I'm finally glad I know how to say her last name. It's been so many years.
It's on record. She really was the hero or heroine behind that auction, because she, you know, the other part about doing those auctions is it's great for someone like, you know, Brian Posehn, Steve Agee to say, yeah, sure, we'll drive out to Riverside and go hang out with someone.
Someone's got
to
organize that.
Guess who has to schedule it? Kulap does. And so we had 60 or 70 auctions, and she had to be in charge of every... Not one comedian said, oh, I'll take care of it. Maybe,
right.
I think Doug Benson is maybe the only one who was like... He said he would go see a movie with anyone in the United States, the continental United States, and someone won, and 3 days later, he went, tracked the guy down, and saw a movie with him. Like, literally 3 days later, like, he's the only one who really, like, sort of...
Well,
took
to
it
be
upon.
Fair, we did get in contact with Mindy and schedule
the
time.
I just mean, like, the comedian's doing the special, like, going to
gotcha.
Places.
Those places. Yeah.
Like, setting up, you know, a comedian who will teach you how to do stand-up over a five-hour seminar.
Sure.
Like, that comedian does not want to schedule, does not want to be talking to a weirdo.
Oh, I have to do that? I thought that was just a cool thing I could say.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so it got to be a little much this year. But the LA Food Bank, I think we've raised $140,000, maybe $150,000 for them, which is great. I mean, you know, and I credit my wife with that, too, because at one point I was like, well, we're going to do these special shows, these Christmas shows, you know, and maybe we should give the money away to someone, you know. And I was like, I don't know who to give the money away to. And Kulap was like, I'm going to investigate this. And she like laid out three different charities that would be good.
And then made him battle it out.
Yes, that's
right.
For your
cash dollars.
And only one remained.
Fuck you, other charities.
But I just think it was something to do with we felt like the economy or something, just the LA Food Bank was, I mean, it's tough for people right now. And we just kind of were like, that's the one that we should pick. For us, it was the clear winner.
Sure.
And they've been amazing. They do great work there.
Was there ever a public explanation why Death Ray switched to Bang Bang?
It's super simple. It's just basically Comedy Death Ray was the show that we did at M Bar and then moved over to UCB. And that was the stand-up show. And then when I started doing the podcast, and again, it wasn't a podcast, it was a radio show, internet radio show,
yeah.
You know, for 500 people mm-hmm. listening. I imagined what that show would be as something very different than what it turned out to be. What I said and what I thought the show was every week, whoever the headliner of Death Ray that week would come do the show to promote the show. And when I say do the show, I mean we would just sit there and talk to them, much like this is, you know, just talk to a comedian.
Yeah.
The show very quickly, A, turned into a podcast, B, got very popular, and C, turned into something that really didn't have anything to do with the live show anymore.
Sure.
So to call it Comedy Death Ray Radio was kind of disingenuous and kind of not really reflective of what BJ Porter and I had started, and it kind of became quickly more popular than the UCB show and something of its own. And BJ was, you know, super cool about, you know, letting me use the name for a while. And then at a certain point, you know, we started Earwolf and we started turning it into a business, and it was just kind of like, and then I started getting like a TV show based on the podcast, which now has nothing to do with Comedy Death Ray,
sure.
You know, and it just kind of became a thing where we talked about it and said that it doesn't really have anything to do with Comedy Death Ray anymore. I should just change it because, you know, it just didn't have any relationship to Comedy Death Ray anymore. So, you know, I changed it, and I think it's been good because, you know, there's no longer kind of any weird confusion between it anymore. I've tried to delineate of like Comedy Death Ray is, or Comedy Bang Bang now is a thing, is like an aesthetic of people working together, but there's the stand-up show, and that's clearly marked Comedy Death Ray stand-up. There's the podcast, which is Comedy Death Ray. I keep saying Comedy Death Ray. Now you're getting me confused. Comedy Bang Bang stand-up, Comedy Bang Bang the podcast, and Comedy Bang Bang the TV show
sure.
are all three different things, but the thing they have in common is like I'm the producer of them.
Right. And so when did you meet Jeff, and like how did you decide to do Earwolf? And
a couple years ago, 1 year into the podcast, I met Jeff. Jeff Ulrich is the other co-founder of Earwolf, which is a podcasting network. We mm-hmm. have a lot of podcasts, much like the Nerdist Network. We do How Did This Get Made? We do Sklarbro Country. We have an
Who Charted?
Yes, with my wife. We have an upcoming show we're very excited about. I met Jeff because he actually contacted me because he was really interested in podcasting and maybe wanted to manage the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the first meeting, he was like, you know, what we should do is just start a network. And I was like, yes, let's do that. Because I love ideas like that of like, let's get a bunch of people together and make something cool. That's yeah. like always what I want to do is like, let's make a big thing.
Yeah.
You know, so we did it and started this network a couple years ago. Now it's I think it's the second anniversary, like right around now of when we started it.
I think we have a similar thing in that way of liking to, you said earlier about, oh, I just like seeing how far we can take things. And mm-hmm. I love the idea that there's no ceiling
mm-hmm.
where it's not like, oh, I'm just going to do this one pot. It's the same reason why, you know, I worked in radio in LA in the 90s. And then someone's like, would you ever want to go back and do radio? Oh. And someone said, would you ever want to go back and do radio again? And I'm like, you know, unless we could be syndicated or something, you're never any bigger than just the city you're in. And it feels
this
very.
Is, by the way, I was the person who asked him this and we didn't record it. So I appreciate you getting it into the podcast here. I appreciate it. He didn't press record yet. So this was our private conversation right
yeah,
before.
Yeah. This, all of it was all the private conversation. Okay. Yeah. Now we're podcasting.
Okay, good.
Okay, good. Scott, you do a lot of, what is it, comedy
things?
We're
finally back around to the question I asked you. Would you ever go back into radio again?
No, but just the idea that, you know, that it's, that things have no ceiling and you can expand them forever,
yeah.
you know, limitlessly.
No, I mean, you know, I mean, why do something unless you're going to try to make it huge? You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. I always just want everything that I do to be the best it can be. You know, I don't necessarily want it to be, I don't want to beat someone else. I just want to, I want the thing to be great. You know what I mean? So if
yeah.
I'm going to do a podcast, well, no, I mean, now I have no ambitions to make my podcast the biggest podcast in the world, because I don't think there's any way to beat you or Mark.
Well, but I don't know if there's any way to be the biggest podcast in the world.
Yeah, because they're all niche programs anyway.
Exactly. I feel like, you know, we're just a part of a cluster of...
Clusterfuck.
A clusterfuck, if you will, that are all sort of in the same, you know, in the same sphere. And
yeah,
so
exactly.
It doesn't, like... doesn't matter to me if, like, oh, Corolla's on top or Earwolf or, you know, or well, Bang Bang's on. It's like we're all in the same region.
What's interesting to me is normally my personality is I would want to overtake Corolla or what have you if I start doing something. That's why I quit stand up, by the way, is because I knew I would never be the best at it. I was just
really hard one. There are definitely some people that you might recognize as, it's just too amorphous to say, like, that person is the best at that art.
But if you don't want to achieve it at the level that Louis C.K. is, sure, or Steve Martin did, you know, then I don't know why you're doing it, you know? And I personally never saw myself achieve. And that's why I quit musical theater back in the day, too, is, like, I never saw myself as being the best at it. So I just was like, I'll try something that I think I can be the best at, you know? And so what's interesting about the podcast to me is my usual personality is I want to be more popular than Mark. I want to be more popular than Adam Carolla. But what's weird about it is I have settled into this strange niche where I'm actually more comfortable being not popular. Like, I'm like, at a certain point, I had a crossroads where I was like, I can go down this route and make my show very personal to me and do what I think is funny and what is probably annoying to other people, to certain people who like certain types of podcasts.
Sure.
Or I can try to make it more general and more generally just a, you know, like a more popular, in other words.
No, you have to. I think especially if you're going to do something with the regularity that you do it, mm-hmm, it has to be fulfilling or you just couldn't.
Yeah.
You just couldn't keep doing it. It wouldn't be, yeah, possible to fake it. I mean, I guess some people can fake it, but I can't. You couldn't fake it for that long.
I'm now very comfortable just saying, you know what? My show is not for everyone, you know, which is like a hard thing to
admit.
But
none of our shows are for everyone.
Yeah, well, that's podcasting in general, like I, right, said. I mean, like, our numbers, while TV numbers shrink ever and ever lower, and we may end up meeting them, matching, like, you know, the NBC's ratings, you know, like, sometimes every once in a while I look at my podcast and I go, NBC, like, whatever was on NBC last night, I got almost the same numbers.
That's the thing, is that it's definitely the ones that are in danger are sort of the low end cable channels.
Mm-hmm.
The ones where you go, wow, it costs, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year to run that network, and they, you know, they get 100,000 viewers.
Yeah.
Like, how are they sustaining that?
Yeah.
Because we have the same, you know, like, you, like, all the podcasts are in the same neighborhood of that.
Yeah.
And it's like, it doesn't cost $100 million to run this shit.
It's very interesting. So, but in any case, I don't know what I was saying, but I'm happy. They're all sort of niche programs, but I'm happy being the niche within the niche.
But I don't. But I think as you continue to grow and expand, which you will, because, you know, I mean, first of all, I want to say a big thank you to IFC and guys like Dan Pasternak who, yeah, really have been recognized.
You can call them. You don't have to say it to me.
I don't like talking to people.
I understand. You don't like talking to suits.
I don't want to.
Fuck those guys.
Yeah, man.
Pass on this message, Ackerman.
They're part of the problem. Wait, you just said they were the solution.
Yeah, you're thanking them.
But they're wearing.
What's happening here?
But it's people seeing, sort of recognizing this phenomenon that's happening and loving good comedy and doing the same thing in their jobs of just like, hey, we just want to program stuff that we love, that we can go to bed every night going, I'm proud of what I put
They're
on the
so
air.
They're so great there at IFC. They love my show. They're happy to work on it. It's so funny because we had a big marketing meeting phone call the other day, and Leo Allen, who's the executive producer on my show, he was on the call and from New York. He was in New York. And afterwards, he called me up, and I said, oh, sorry, Leo, if you didn't want to be on that, or, you know, I don't know I'm interested in marketing, but he was like, they love this show so much. He goes, I feel like I learned something from them. Like, they have such passion for what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're so smart there. They love the show. Like, I've never been in this situation. I've always been at networks who hate you and want to crush you.
Right.
You know?
Or they have their own ideas about what the show is that aren't yours. And
I've literally, the last TV show I made for a network that shall remain nameless, when they called me to tell me they were not picking it up, they said, look, let me be honest with you. We had a little extra money in the budget. We didn't really like this project. We were like, I don't know. We have to spend it. We went ahead and just took a chance on it. None of us really expected it to go. I'm like, why didn't you say? I wouldn't have wasted my time.
Did we not mention any of that?
Yeah, no. Of course, when you talk to them, when they're pitching you to work on it, they're like, oh, we love this celebrity and we want this show to be popular. So it's so great to be at a place like IFC who is just passionate about what they're doing and they're putting on really great shit.
I found that, and I can say that you know that I'm not full of shit because they did not pick up the show, but Furman and I did Time Hole pilot mm-hmm. for them.
I heard it was great.
And it was really fun. And then in the end, they didn't pick it up, but their notes were really good notes, which is rare too.
You're not like used to it.
Where they get you to ask the right questions and go try to flesh this out and really justify why you're doing this. And then we would come away from those notes phone calls and be like, fuck, those were really good notes. We should be doing those things.
Well, it's like I was talking to David Cross about Todd Margaret because the person Christine from IFC who was in charge of his show got put onto my show because Dan Pasternak had to move on to a different show. And I was like, how is Christine? And he was like, she gave me one note that made me rethink the entire series and made it so great.
Oh,
wow.
I was
like, I mean, there's no like higher praise for executives than that. So.
Right, from David Cross.
Yeah, exactly, you know. So I just really went into it. We all have a level of respect for each other. They've been great about if I feel strongly that one of their notes isn't something that works, they've been fantastic about saying, okay. And I feel like I've been good about listening to their notes. And it's just been, I mean, and not that there are a ton. I feel like we're putting out a great show. And it's you know, I think it's really special. I'm really, really proud of it.
What is the presentation of the Bang Bang TV show?
Well, it's basically what I did was when they offered me a TV show, I said, what is the visual version of my TV show? And I don't mean like what is like the Howard Stern just pointing a camera at me doing the TV show. I said, what is my TV show in one sentence? Or what is my podcast in one sentence? And if I had to describe it, I would say it's me talking to celebrities in a talk show format and then fake characters come on.
Sure.
And we all talk to each other. Okay. And it deviates from that sometimes. But I said, what is the visual version of that? Okay. And when I stopped thinking about it like, okay, I'm just going to do my podcast and film it. And what is the visual version of that? What is a fake talk show? Mm-hmm. That's what it is it's a crazy fake talk show with characters and celebrities and comedy bits and me as the host. And it's my sense of humor. And we are often doing wild digressions into strange comedy pieces. And it's really interesting. I think it's a really interesting show. And there really is not, this is so, I know someone's going to bust me on
it.
I'll
say it. There's nothing else like it on television.
I have not seen another show on it like it on television. The one thing that I saw that was close is after we wrapped, I watched Knowing Me, Knowing You with Alan Partridge.
Sure.
And that's the closest thing I've seen to it. But that is totally scripted,
right?
Or it seemed totally scripted to me. The difference being is my show is actually improv'd,
right.
Which is scarier for me, a guy who's not, you know, done a lot of improv. But I mean, the podcast is training ground for it. But my show is probably 70% improv.
Knowing me, Alan Partridge, knowing you, Scott Aukerman.
Aha!
Oh.
So I mean, I think it's going to be really fascinating. I hope everyone watches it. IFC
June 8th.
Yeah. It's
what time?
10, it's either 10 or 10:30. They haven't told me, but it's paired with Kurt Braunohler's show Bunk.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Bunk sounds hilarious too.
Yeah,
I think that's a good, and I think it's smart to block like-minded, mm-hmm. you know, shows together so that people don't just have to tune in one, like, oh, I gotta nail that one show. Like, you can actually watch a nice block of programming.
You can actually take an hour out of your goddamn lives to,
I don't know,
you know,
if that's a good approach
support someone
to the audience.
Who you
I don't
claim
know. Whoa,
to
Scott,
enjoy.
Whoa, hey, hit the cough button. Oh, sorry. Scott's having a bit of a, that's an emotional cough.
God.
You all right?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, we'll
Thank
cut
God
all that
out.
Cough
button.
Yeah, we'll cut
Yeah, you'll
that.
Cut the whole thing out, right? You'll cut the first 80 minutes out of this podcast, right?
Yep, that's right. And we're only at 62, so we'll cut the first 80.
You'll have a negative 18.
Negative 18. Now we're going to owe people.
I'm looking at the Nerdist podcast on iTunes. It's
negative
18 minutes?
Yeah, I don't know.
They're going to give me 18 minutes of my life back?
I think, you have to. That's right. We give you 18 choice minutes of your life.
Not choice minutes. Back. It's the 18 minutes at the end of your life when you're on your deathbed. It's the 18 minutes you were
you
in
just
the
get
most
to relive
pain,
over and over
like
again.
Where you're constantly hitting the morphine
Why
button.
Why didn't
but
I
you're
take
out.
That? Oh, no. That, those are only for the people who forgot they had 18 minutes and they just didn't spend them until the end. They're like, ah, shit.
Ah, that was 18. Now I just got to sit here.
Oh, no. I've been gutted.
My family left already. They said goodbye.
I've been shot in the face by a laser. This is the worst thing that's ever happened.
Oh, you're in the Nerdist. Is that coming up?
Yeah.
Are people going to be, really, you know more about this than anyone
Laser guns.
Else.
Laser guns.
Laser guns!
I don't know if you ever saw G.I. Joe or Transformers or Star Wars, but people shoot lasers at each other.
Wow.
Technically, Star Wars is in the distant past. Still,
they buried that
technology. It's coming back around! It's coming back around.
It's possible, right, to shoot a laser gun at someone? I mean, let's not get too technical here, but is it possible to shoot a laser at someone
It's just about finding an efficient power source. Like, you can shoot a beam at someone.
Right, an energy beam of some sort?
Yeah, but I think it's just finding the efficient portable power source that can
make it powerful enough
to shoot someone in the...
Because really, all those stormtroopers that should have been, like, they should have had to plug their guns in.
They should have had to plug the gun, or they should have had to, like in the movie Real Genius, take you into a laboratory.
A laboratory.
And aim it at you. You'd have to stand in front of the cinder blocks.
Right.
And then aim a very, you know, large, clunky laser at you.
Have you ever thought about remaking Real Genius with you as the star? I think that's the Chris Hardwick movie.
I'd like to play all of the parts.
Yes. I would like
to
film you playing all of the parts and not release it.
But I still want William Atherton on it.
Oh, okay, sure.
Still want William Atherton on it.
If Atherton's in, I'm in.
I watch Real Genius is one of those movies that I just watch every like year or so. Like, I'm just going to watch this
again.
Your
whole personality is based on Val Kilmer in that movie, I would have to say.
When I was a kid, I wanted to be Chris Knight so bad.
Mm.
Number one, I was not that smart. I mean, I wasn't that level of... I'm not that.
Come on, Chris, you're pretty smart.
I'm pretty smart, Scott. I'm pretty smart. I'm pretty smart, but I'm not super, super smart. I'm not Chris Knight smart. But yeah, I always love that idea of, and I think it's why I like Doctor
Who
so much.
You're Grande smart. Chris Knight, he's venti smart.
That's
me,
where it flips.
I'm tall smart.
No, Asians, venti smart.
Yeah.
Then white people again at the Grande level.
Right in the middle. And then
we are just in
don't,
the...
Please don't say who is tall smart.
I wasn't going to say a tall smart.
Come on, Chris.
I was not going to say any tall smart.
I'm
going
to cover your mouth because you're
going
to say something
I know
terrible.
That you think that I was going somewhere with tall
please,
smart, but
Chris,
I was not
I
going anywhere with tall
that
smart.
Type of humor.
I don't cotton to your tall smart accusations.
Tall smart accusations. Is that the title of the show?
Tall smart accusations.
Hi, welcome to Tall Smart Accusations. I'm Chris Hardwick.
It's nice to be here.
I'm neither tall nor smart, but I make accusations.
Scott, how dare you? yeah, I think Real Genius was one of the defining movies of my youth, but it can't ever be remade.
I'm trying to think of the most defining movie of my youth. Definitely the David Letterman show was the most defining, like, entertainment thing of my entire... It shaped my...
Oh, I like that. I like that. I can definitely see that playing itself out in what you're doing.
My TV show is very influenced by early David Letterman.
Oh,
so
that's cool.
I was looking at something that was... I was kind of looking at old clips after we made it, and I saw a joke on it that I was like, oh, that's just something that we either did on my show or would have done on my show.
Yeah.
But it's like they're lost to the recesses of time because you can't see any of those shows except for like YouTube clips now.
Oh, man, I know. It's so weird when the internet fails you that way. You're like, you're supposed to have everything.
Yeah, every single thing that exists. I guess you have to go to the Museum of TV. Maybe they have all the early Lettermans, but that's the whole thing is like, can you really watch every episode of Letterman again? He made so many of them that it was like I already lived watching every episode of
Don't
Letterman.
Don't you feel like our generation of people, though, could, instead of watching current Letterman every night, just watch a classic Abraham Letterman every night before bed? I feel like people would do that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. You should. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you definitely should do that.
I mean, his show was... the original Letterman show was so in the spirit of where podcasting is now.
Oh, yeah.
Of just, I mean, like, let's fuck around and try a bunch of stuff and who gives a shit.
I say this with no hyperbole. It invented people's senses of humor now. Honestly, it did. It invented looking at things ironically and being sarcastic about stuff. I mean, I've made this allusion before, but the show Big Brother, the reality show,
yeah.
When it came over here, it was a Swedish, I believe, format, and the producers were the Swedish people who did it in Sweden. And they
Swedish chef, right?
Yeah, the Swedish chef was heavily involved.
Yeah, he's the Simon Cowell of.
And so they had a chicken coop cam, and they thought that was the greatest idea of all time. And they talked about that was a big feature on the first season of Big Brother. I don't know if you remember this.
I don't.
But a cam just trained on the chicken coop. And they thought that was hilarious. And they would talk about it all the time. And then they show it on American TV and everyone just shrugs at it because we have Letterman.
Right.
We have senses of humor. We know that it's funny to point a camera at something random.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, I before that, I don't think anyone, you know, I just think people's senses of humor changed.
I think there were a few. I mean, I think Steve Allen or maybe even Ernie Kovacs or
oh, yeah, everyone
I think
forefathers.
Groucho or Sid Caesar, you know, they're definitely or George Burns. Like there were some, but culturally that was not.
I've never seen just such a massive shift in people's personalities to where like when he kind of took over. I mean, everything in humor changed.
Yeah,
it really did. I mean,
because that was we were the right age for that, and our generation sort of swept that up, and then
right.
and then we got, you know, then we got the Simpsons and the Conans and the
they're all influenced by it.
Yeah,
they're all influenced by it.
Well, I'm greatly looking forward to Comedy Bang Bang, and
you want to come over and watch it in our PJs?
Yes. I will come over and watch it in our PJs,
and then listen to PJ Harvey records.
I love it. Down by the Water. Oh, she did that great duet with Tom York.
Oh yeah, yeah. Hi, Tom York.
Yeah.
Welcome to the studio. The mics are on. Yeah, we're recording.
Thanks, PJ Harvey. It's great to be here. Which way am I looking? I don't know.
That's a little joke because he has a lazy eye.
I'm going to cut that out.
Are you?
I think so.
All right. It's yeah, just, why make an enemy with Tom York?
Well, he's never going to hear it, but it's unnecessarily mean.
That's true.
It's a low blow. And I'm only in for high blows.
High blow. You should call your show that.
High blow.
High blows with Chris Hardwick. And edit point. All right. Well,
Earwolf Comedy Bang Bang. Comedy Bang Bang premiering on IFC June 8th.
Friday, June 8th.
10 or 10:30.
We're going all summer long. We have 10 episodes. And the very first episode, we have Zach Galifianakis, Andy Daly, and Will Forte are all on the show. And as well as guest star roles from Tom Lennon and Gillian Jacobs. That's
great.
The first episode. So,
what? There's more than that?
There's more than one episode. Yeah, we decided to make more
Fuck.
Than one. But yeah, every episode has amazing people on it, and I'm very, very proud of them. I think they're really funny.
Well, I think you know, and I've said this to you before off mic, but I do.
I've been waiting for you to say it on mic because that's the only way that
that's
counts.
The only way that really matters, because then other people hear it. but you know, whether or not most people know or are aware or will admit it, but just the thing that you started 10 years ago, I think much in the same way that you were talking about Letterman, has really influenced so much of comedy in our culture that I don't think would have been allowed to grow in the way that it grew were that not there.
That's nice of you to say. I don't know that I agree with it, but thank you so much.
I'm telling you, if there had not been a Comedy Death Ray, I just don't. You know, that really pulled the community together, and I think helped the Pattons and people like that
Maybe.
Grow.
I think the UCB Theater had more to do with it than me, but I appreciate that. And Chris, I've said this to you on mic, but I will also say to you off mic, but I'm glad we're friends.
I am too, Scott. That was a really high blow.
Welcome to High Blows.
Shit, now I can't get out that thing because it references high blows and no one's going to know what high blows are. All right.
We all have to make choices.
Damn it. Enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is domain name registration that is simple. To register your domain, visit Nerdist.hover.com.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.